Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco, as we continue our Why You Should series. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our episodes. 1517 is more than podcasts. In fact, the last episode that you heard from us was while all of us were gathered at one of 1517's many conferences. We were at the Here We Still Stand regional event in Northwest Arkansas. If you missed that event and you sort of like what you saw or heard online, or if you've been wanting to come to one of these, tickets are on sale for our national event in San Diego, California. That's a very fun event. It's longer than the one in Bentonville, and it all occurs at one location.
It is truly an event more than just a conference.
It truly is an event, not just a conference.
It's a party.
It's a lot of fun, and we missed it for the last 2 years, and so it's awesome that it's coming back. And like I said, you can get tickets now online, and I'll put a link in the show notes for that. Full disclosure, I'm not the best podcast producer in the world. So my dad and I are currently, Adam looks cozy inside his office at home. We're currently standing outside in the snow in a covered awning in Estes Park, Colorado. Just because
didn't some elk just wander by?
They're right there.
Yeah, there's some elk right there.
Oh man,
they're like 100
elk
feet.
Steaks are delicious.
Oh, that would be
my trigger finger's getting itchy.
It's currently 33 degrees.
It's 33. We've got our hands in our pockets.
Caleb's got his new puffy jacket on that he bought yesterday.
And I'm wearing socks and sandals. So you can tell that a lot of intelligence being put into this morning's podcast. But we're doing this because I'm not good at prepping for when I leave. And so I realized sort of last minute that we needed to record more than we did.
As in yesterday. Afternoon.
No, I've known for days. I just didn't want to break it to you.
What wasn't it your birthday recently? So you're probably in that afterglow of...
It was my birthday.
Turning what? What are you like? You're 27. Not even 30 yet, are you?
No, I turned 27. Yeah.
Look at, when you get old, you look at people like, you're not even 30 yet. What are you? You're feeble.
We've been, it's not an excuse. We've been driving across the country. I've been sleeping in a tent at nights. I knew this was coming. I didn't know where the best location to do this was. Turns out gorgeous Estes Park, Colorado in the Rockies has amazing 5G, and we can stream to Adam, and we can record this. So it works out.
Yeah. It would have been better if you would have hold up in that hotel there where they filmed The Shining.
Oh, no.
Was that filmed here?
Yeah. I don't do that kind of thing.
We could have done an episode on demonology.
I don't think
we know anything about. But,
no, we don't.
All I know is that freaks me out.
That's for when we've truly run out of any content we could do.
You ever stayed at a hotel where they're like, and let me tell you about the ghost stories in this hotel? I'm like, yeah, check me out.
That's great.
We have to have Mark Pearson on, a pastor in Long Beach. He and I and a few other people that you guys know, I think you know them, went on we were in St. Louis, and we decided just at the sort of drop of a hat that we were going to go try to figure out where that famous exorcism case took place. And
oh, yeah, because that happened in St. Louis, right?
Yeah, we ended up talking with, for a good hour or so, the last living guy or person. I don't want to use gendered language.
Please use gendered language on the show.
You have been in that city too long.
No, but the last living guy, he was an attendant, kind of like a nurse. He was a member of some Catholic religious order who was a part of that case. It was fascinating.
Well, today's
anyway,
Why You
Should. That was a bit of a distraction.
Terrifying.
Yeah, today's Why You Should has nothing to do with this. Actually, it has to do with a little comment Adam made at the end of the last episode. You snuck in right at the end this great little throw out that the Reformation wouldn't have happened without Soliman, right? And you went on a little excursus about the Turk and the...
You could see the twinkle in his eyes because we let him talk about Islam for a minute.
It's the one thing I know about.
Well, so now we're going to do, and we've, like I said, we're recovering some of the material we've done in the past. We're looking at a new light. We did like a couple episodes, three or four, on Islam with you. in the past. And so now this is a great opportunity because I don't know that much about it. I know very little. I guess the minimum that you should know. Maybe I don't. I think same with my dad. You know a lot more than us. So Adam, why should you know a little bit about Islam?
Go.
Make the case.
Well, I think the real quick and maybe obvious answer is it's the second largest religion in the world. Soon to be, maybe already is, the second largest religion in the United States. I'm a little leery of any sort of polling data because every organization, whether it's Pew or Barna or U.S. News and World Report or whatever, you know, they all differ. But most suggest that by 2050, Islam will surpass Christianity, both here in the United States, well, not here in the United States, but across the globe, and will surpass Judaism here in the United States as the second most influential religion here in the U.S. So that's and
is
if you look at Islam,
by just population, that's like number of
people and that,
who are Islamic.
Yeah, and you'll get like Muslim apologists who will suggest that that's because people are seeing the light of Islam and so on. The real all polls, suggest that it's just simply birth rate.
It's
Muslims are
it's that the
families.
Christian West has stopped having babies.
Yeah.
And that the Muslim East has continued to have babies.
What's
interesting? And if you buy into that adage, I forget who said it first, but demographics are destiny, or the future belongs to those who show up for it. That's kind of significant. For Scott, for you and I, we have what, 50 years left?
Boy.
Maybe 60. Hopefully
60.
A lot less.
I'm going to be 50.
He's already 50.
But
I'd be 110. That'd be remarkable and weird. For my genes, I probably have 20 years left.
Oh, don't say that.
Well, for our children and our grandchildren, we'll be around to see, I don't know, I don't want to put it in ominous terms, but the eclipse of Christianity globally speaking in terms of numbers.
So I had heard that before. I mean, I started hearing that maybe like a decade ago, right? Maybe more. Time is a flat circle, as Jonah Goldberg would say. I've recently heard that there's some sort of shifting ideas on this just because of sort of the birth rate thing is hitting the Islamic world as well as they immigrate into European countries more and more. Have you not heard that?
That it's kind of flattening?
Yeah, that they're reassessing sort of the growth rate of Islam based on sort of evolving birth rates as Islamic people immigrate into Western Europe, Canada, the United States, South America.
Yeah, well, a couple things there is, yes, I have. Even this is maybe going back 10 years ago, they were saying in Europe as immigrant Muslims begin to assimilate slowly but surely, they also start to embrace kind of the European values of having smaller families and so on. So there are those, and I guess they're probably being proven true, who are saying this will all flatten out. Maybe it is flattening out. But you mentioned immigration. It was not too long ago, 10, maybe 15 years ago, that the demographic predictors, were saying that by 2050, the majority of populations in major European cities were going to be Muslim. And that would have massive ramifications for politics, such that people were calling Europe Eurabia and so on. I don't know that that'll all turn out the way they were predicting, but yet another reason just to be aware of it. I don't think it's as ominous as I once did. Not because of demographic trends changing. I think that while there still is a large, at least numerically, segment of the Muslim population that holds on to that old view of things, that would see the goal of the Muslim life as advancing the cause of Islam wherever you might live, I think more and more many, many Muslims are assimilating into the countries that they're settling in. And while they still believe Islamic doctrine, the political and legal components of Islam aren't as, at least currently, as important for them.
It kind of be, I mean, and you should probably make the sort of give the reason why politically this could have ramifications. But I mean, the theological implications we should get into too. But it seems like this is almost, the fear used to be that the more sort of Islamic immigration you had in country, the more politically active they became, the more they were going to enact Sharia law in various places and sort of supplant, in our case, constitutional law. And probably, I guess, the Western Europeans would argue that they have constitutional law too. One might disagree with them a little bit, but I'm sure they would argue that. But that's almost like arguing that if Jewish people immigrated, that you'd sort of get this influx of Talmudic law into the political order. And
don't you think the risk was the sheer number of people?
Like, yeah, but it always seemed like a stretch to me, especially in the United States, that, you know, this could...
Well, you'd have to get, like, 50% of senators and congressmen to become...
Well, you'd also have to get past legal challenges and the whole nine yards and the court system, which seems to have been sort of the bulwark against this kind of thing, even when the politics goes wonky.
I mean, you're talking a huge demographic majority is what it would... Not an influx.
A demographic majority of, active Muslims versus active Christians, but like just a sheer demographic majority.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because the nuns are, they're climbing
not the religious
also.
Yeah,
folks,
the
no religion.
Yeah,
they're climbing up as well in numbers.
Yeah,
in
I guess that's my point. Okay, so when you thought this would politically be a big deal, why did you think that?
Well, that's what the demographic data was suggesting, and that we were seeing. So let's go back 10, 12 years to 2010. We were seeing with sort of at the very beginning of when ISIS began to emerge, you were seeing not large amounts of people, but a significant number of people from European or Western countries, America and Europe, mostly Europe, going to places like Syria and Iraq, to be members, citizens, if you will, though that's an anachronistic term for Islam, of this Islamic State. Because in traditional Islamic doctrine, if there is a place that is ruled by Sharia law, that's Islamic law, that's drawn from the Quran and the example that Muhammad set that's contained in his biography and in what are called the Hadith, you're required to live there.
Yeah, you have you have a religious and moral requirement. Instead of complaining that there's not Sharia in your country, you got to get up and go.
Back in those days, maybe it wasn't 10 years ago, but ISIS had a huge swath of territory from Syria to Iraq. They had little enclaves in North Africa, and it looked like this thing was unstoppable until a certain president... Are we allowed to say his name on the air? President Trump basically gave the Marine Corps the go, get rid of them. And they went and destroyed ISIS in a pretty short amount of time. So all that stuff, I mean, the global trend suggests that this was on that political Islam, if we want to call it that, or Islamism. You know, that's basically just traditional Islam was on the rise. And I think it's off the radar now, not because it's not around and not a significant force, globally speaking, but I think it's sort of other priorities have been put on before us by the media. You know, the pandemic and now war in Ukraine and so on and so forth.
And culture issues.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think we realize that we've got our own house is a mess. So we're more focused on that.
So on the theological side, is it fairly easy to sort of give a, five points of Islam, sort of explanation of the theological tenets of Islam?
I don't know why you chose the number five, but that's the perfect number. Not like perfect biblical number or anything like that.
I was thinking Calvinism and Tulip, I'll be honest.
Oh, well, I won't. I won't take the bait on that. But, the Quran says in several places there are five basic doctrines to Islam. The first is the doctrine of rather than monotheism, they'll say unicity of God, that God is one in essence and in person. He does not have a son. He did not have a female consort, the Quran says in several places. So it's a Unitarian type of monotheism. Second major doctrine would be the doctrine of creation that says there's both visible and invisible aspects to creation. There's an emphasis in the Quran on the invisible side of things, the reality of angels and jinn.
The jinn.
Yeah, we're not talking like Bombay Sapphire or...
No, J-I-N,
beef
like
eater, but we're talking genies that
Adam,
are
Adam went right
everywhere.
To Bombay Sapphire. Yeah.
Well, that used to be my gin, but
no,
I've moved to vodka. Third and fourth doctrines are the doctrine of the prophets and the books. That is to say, one of the things that's kind of surprising for Christian readers of the Quran or first-time readers of the Quran is just how many biblical names appear. From Adam to Noah to Abraham, John the Baptist, though he's not called the Baptist in the Quran. Name is Yahya in the Quran, and Jesus are, and there's about about 20 more biblical names in the Quran, and they're all regarded as, from the Quranic view, as prophets of Islam. So for Muslims, while Islam begins in the early 7th century, with the rise of the so-called prophet Muhammad, a Muslim theologian will tell you that Islam has been around since day one. Adam was the first prophet in Islam. And Allah, they would say, has not only revealed himself through prophets, but that prophetic word has been inscribed in books.
This is a trend with some of the, like with the young religions, right? And most of, I think, what we would call the young religions really spin off of Christianity and Judaism, Mormonism would be another example, right? Where they need, I think there's we're taking away the benefit of the doubt, assuming that these are invented new sort of modern
that's my assumption.
Religions.
Yeah.
That's my assumption for both Mormonism and Islam, is that the founder knows you need a backbone, right? You can't say I'm the first prophet. Like people have been practicing religions that have history, prophets, tradition for too long to come convert those en masse without an appeal to that. And so Islam needs Christianity and Judaism to thrive. So do the Mormons. So do any of the new Christian cults.
Yeah. Islam, in a way, kind of writes itself into the certainly the Old Testament narrative. But a little bit into the New Testament narrative, and then changes it around. That fourth doctrine, the doctrine of the books, Muslims will tell you, and the Quran mentions a few biblical books. It refers to the Torah, the first five of the Old Testament. It refers to the Psalms. It refers to the Injil or the Gospel, as if these were these are Islamic texts. And you ask a Muslim, how is it the Quran would say such things when clearly they don't correspond well or connect well with the Quran, and they'll say, well, at one point they did, but the texts themselves have been corrupted. Here's where they'll use modern, if you will, I'll use air quotes over Zoom, biblical scholarship, more liberal type biblical scholarship. They'll draw on that to.
That's such an interesting example because those people maintain strong criticism precisely because they, liberal Christianity has failed at changing the canon, removing pieces in mass, right? They attempt to, and they try to, the only success they have is removing it from people's minds, but never from the page itself. So if you're using that as your example of alterations, modern biblical criticism has failed pretty handily at, number one, showing that there's been a lot of alterations, and number two, altering it itself.
Right, but see, you're thinking about facts and like details.
looking for something verifiable.
I'll tell you though, what's interesting, and we've talked about this probably a couple of years back. Modern Muslim polemicists and apologists, defenders of Islam, and those Muslims who would go after other religions, love the work of Bart Ehrman.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah.
And they love Ehrman's claim, for example, in Misquoting Jesus, where he said there would be no doctrine of the deity of Jesus had there not been the Council of Nicaea.
Right.
Which, if you just do a shallow dive into history, you know that's monumentally stupid, because we know from outside biblical texts, already in the first century, Christians were gathering on Sunday morning singing hymns to Jesus as God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But
as a separate God than God the Father.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, the other popular one is Paul sort of inventing a religion, right? That, like, yep. the Gospels, and I've heard more specifically sort of those, the unaccepted, the Gnostic Gospels, right? The ones that didn't make it into the canon.
Yeah, that were written
tell a story about a guy, a special Jewish teacher.
Yeah.
And really it takes, 60 years or so for this zealot named Paul to invent a religion out of this in order to sort of turn the tide,
There's all sorts of, Muslim writers who are writing on Christianity or the relationship between Islam and Christianity go to great lengths to concoct theories on why the vast differences between Islam and Christianity, solely because the Quran is so emphatic that Jesus was a prophet of Islam. In fact, his first miracle in chapter 19 of the Quran has Jesus right after his birth looking up at Mary and saying, "Don't worry, Mary, even though you're not married and you're a virgin and you got to go back to your people and explain how you now have a baby, don't worry, it's all going to be all right because I'm a prophet of Allah." So, I mean, they kind of have to do that sort of that stuff. A lot of it looks like conspiracy theory. You mentioned these Gnostic Gospels. There is a non-canonical gospel, not written by a Gnostic, but called the Gospel of Barnabas, mm-hmm. that Muslims love to refer to as if that was the gospel the Quran is making mention of.
That is so crazy, Adam, because I was in a lecture with a higher critic who is basically saying that the four synoptic gospels are essentially based off of Barnabas.
And then, that's remarkable, because we know the Gospel of Barnabas is a 15th century forgery.
That's amazing.
We have three manuscripts of it in European languages. It was done by, we're pretty sure, a former Dominican who had converted to Islam in the Ottoman Empire and wrote that to use as sort of an evangelism, so to speak, tool. For Christians.
So that was, this was essentially then a secular person sort of going with a Islamic narrative about scripture, right?
Does he have he or she have a PhD?
Yeah, probably from a good British school, and I'm sure should this be, lecture was in
should
the
be
UK.
Taken away. That's absurd. The fifth doctrine before we get off is the doctrine of the last day in Islam. That is, there will be a last day, there will be a general resurrection from the dead, and all people will be judged on the basis of their good and bad deeds.
So, how are those good and bad deeds defined in Islam?
They're defined by whether your actions and your thoughts and everything in between are permitted by what we'd call Sharia law. The path to paradise. Sharia is a word for road or path. It's usually just translated law, but the way it's viewed in the at least in a Quranic context, is if you get on this path, this Sharia, and you follow the example of Muhammad and his teachings in the Quran, or Allah's teachings in the Quran, you're much more guaranteed to go to paradise than not. So whether your deeds are good if they are, if you will, legitimized by Muhammad's behavior, Muhammad's example. Muhammad's seen as the perfect man in Islam.
There's definitely forms of Christianity that would view Jesus the same way.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, as the way, as in if you follow the example of Jesus.
Yeah, there's a hyperbolic statement in Luther's, I think it's a commentary on the Psalms, where he's, again, it's hyperbole, but he's talking about the context. He's talking about kind of a legalistic type of Christianity that says Christianity is all about following the example of Jesus. And he says something like, and Muhammad's example is even better. And in those dark moments when I'm experiencing Anfechtung, Luther says, in those moments, Muhammad almost becomes my prophet.
Oh,
it's a,
that's
it's a remarkable. I mean, Luther's good for those sorts of
yeah
hyperboles, but yes, there certainly is. I think if
can
you look
it be
at the
boiled down to like you know, in Christianity, if you get, because I'm thinking a lot of Muslims in America, right? You'll see the ones that go on the news and assure you that they're not interested in Sharia, and mm-hmm. they'll say things like that. I'm not interested in Sharia. If that's the basic tenet of salvation, the law, what does it get replaced with now in Christianity?
Well, could they be saying they're not interested in a political Sharia?
I mean,
like
probably.
You could say the that's same thing. I could say I'm not interested in God's law as a politician. I'm interested in civil law. That doesn't mean that I'm not interested in God's law theologically. It just means that yep. I'm not trying to enforce the Ten Commandments as a rule for life by which you can be arrested or incarcerated or not.
That's exactly.
Although, murder.
But it's disingenuous because the way you would determine if something was unethical as you were passing laws is you would run it through your system, which is the law.
I'm not saying it's disingenuous. I'm just saying it could be said.
Yeah. And there is a, and I don't want to, don't read this as a conspiracy theory or anything like that, but there's a couple terms in Islam. One's
so this
taqiyya.
Isn't like Caleb's belief in a flat earth.
Oh my gosh.
No. Taqiyya and Kitman, and there's a few others that permit, some would say require that Muslims conceal the truth or deceive.
Right.
Especially if it's for the sake of advancing the cause of Islam. Right. So you can suspend sort of the full program or
isn't that
or
true
take a gradual
with a lot of sort of their observance of Sharia law that it can be suspended when it's applied to a non-Muslim?
Yes. Yep.
No.
Even including like prohibitions against things as horrendous as say rape and murder.
Say some more. What do you mean?
Well,
they can commit violations against the law as long as it's against.
Violations against the law as long as it's not against a Muslim.
Correct. Yeah, but those. Okay. Yeah.
Oh.
There is a sort of hierarchy of.
See, that would be foreign to most Christians because the law applies to like the worst.
It's universal,
people.
Right?
Yeah.
It might not have been foreign to, you know, the way Christianity was perceived, you know, during sort of like. The expansion of the Roman Empire into the new lands, right? I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure there were some native peoples in this country who were sort of offered the choice to convert, and if they didn't convert, were treated as though they were inhuman.
Well, I'll give you a personal example. I have interestingly, I'd call him a friend, who in Southern California, we used to do, it was either Muay Thai or Judo together. He came to the United States.
It's one of those martial arts that I've, you know, mastered in my life.
No, I've not mastered any. I'm still getting beat up every day. But, so Southern California, he was from Afghanistan. His father was dead, but was a, one of these, you heard about these warlords in Afghanistan. Very austere Muslim. Not Taliban, he said, but very serious Muslim. Anyway, Mo, we called him. We were out in the parking lot one day, and he says, "You know, Adam, you know a lot about Islam. It's a wonder you haven't converted." And I said, "Well, I've got some issues." Islam. He goes, "Well, he issued to me the call to Islam. In Islamic law, if you're called to Islam and you reject it." Some will say you get a couple opportunities, but when you're part of like the Deobandi sect of Islam, that's the stuff you see in like Afghanistan and Pakistan, the real austere stuff, you get one opportunity. And if you reject it, you're either enslaved or killed. So he gives me the call to Islam, and this other Muslim, actually a real good friend of mine, says, "Don't do that, Mo." And Mo says, "I'm just kind of joking because you know, if we were in Afghanistan, I'd make him my slave right now. But here we're in America, which we're going to remain friends." That's how weird it sometimes gets. How
is that why you moved to Chicago?
Yeah. It wasn't, you know, much before he moved to Chicago. I remember him talking about that.
Yeah. So there is, in Islam, there is, you know, the real hardcore rhetoric you hear from Islam that some will say, oh, that's not true, authentic Islam. That's baloney. That is traditional Islam. Islam that's made its way into Europe and America that has assimilated a bit is not the real deal of Islam.
We understand this, right? So, how many people, you know, look at Orthodox Christianity that cares about, you know, scripture at all and go, that's not what real Christians believe.
Well, right. I'd say I'd go the other way. So if that's what their texts actually say, you know, if that's, so let's say their texts say that that's how you should be treated if you were issued an invitation, right? That is different than Christianity, where it truly is an aberration if somebody goes out to a non-Christian and says, I now have the right to treat you poorly because you're not a Christian. In fact, you get the exact opposite in the Christian texts. You know, you even get to the point of Jesus saying, pay
turn
taxes.
The other cheek.
Turn the other cheek, pay taxes to this pagan who is enslaving you in your country because it's his money.
Well,
and it's like, that is... I honestly believe you can say, in terms of Christianity, those Christians who committed those atrocities in the name of Christ were not actually
following the doctrine,
or doing anything in the name of Christ. They were doing it to their own reward and to their own benefit.
The Crusades and the Salem witch trials, which are sort of in high school history textbooks, are the sort of the big events that are used to describe the story of Christianity. Which is very strange. Yeah.
There's no, there's no scriptural demand for those events.
No, they're right? Aberrations, as your dad said.
Or they're political actions of Christian rulers or states people.
Yeah, I am not aware of, other than if you're talking about sort of the theocracy of the Hebrew people, there being sort of any political mandates at all in the New Testament, except for. Be a good citizen of the country in which you live and pay unto Caesar what is Caesar's. I'm not aware of any. Are you? I mean, literally, Romans 13, Paul goes on a tirade to say, even if you don't agree with the authorities under which you live, they carry the sword for a reason.
Well, and in fact, and if, you know, in the multiple, you know, with Christianity spreading throughout Rome, if and until the emperor converts, you're just going to be persecuted, right?
Like, and it's, you should not accept that persecution.
Yeah, it's not like gonna. It's no assassination attempt against Nero in order to set up a Christian emperor. Right?
Yeah, which makes it just makes it so much weirder. Like the moves we have going on in this country by Christians to retake America in the name of Christ. It's just weird.
Yes, I think that's the academic term for it. Weird.
Yeah. I can't wrap my head around it. It's max of other religions. I guess that's why it bothers me so much.
Yeah. You know, I gave a talk on Christ and culture about 2 months ago at some retreat. And we were talking about how while Americans may historically have been a Christian people, there's freedom. The promise of free exercise of religion, the First Amendment, and also the prohibition of establishing any religion in America, and how it would be unconstitutional to try to create a Christian America in some sort of institutional sense. And somebody raised their hand and said, it would also be un-Christian.
Yeah.
Which I thought, oh, that's fascinating. That's true and fascinating that we're not under orders or compulsion or... obligated to try to create some sort of
it's actually vocational, right? It's like, why I might vote for particular representatives who maybe are Christian or intend or say they want to rule in correspondence with Christian law or whatever, mostly because as somebody who in a country that allows me to vote for representatives or legislation or what however you may it, I'm going to make decisions that I think positively impact me and my family the places that I live. It's not about the advancement of Christianity when I vote. It's about what's going to make my life easier.
Yeah, I would maybe say, and you guys, I don't think you'll find this problematic. I would prefer judges and lawyers and a legal system that paid some respect to natural law.
Yeah.
I know natural law is very hazy and it's not necessarily interpreted in a Christian way, but I think done right, it doesn't...
You could say...
It's not out of sync with biblical ethics, if you will.
Why? I would prefer representatives and judges that pay, due deference to the Constitution of the United States, which has incorporated several elements of natural law into it in order to protect your rights as a citizen of this country. Now, at the end of the day, that's not a...
evangelistic.
That's not evangelistic
event.
At all. And I think it's interesting that the same sort of Christian right group of individuals that would be that 10, 12 years ago, as you talk, Adam, that you were giving speeches to and talks to because they were so afraid of Islam, bringing the tenets of their religion into the political cultural system of the United States, would want the same to happen with Christianity. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is the one of the cases was just decided by the Supreme Court was this coach who keeps praying on the field and was told not to and all this. And my wife and I were driving, we're listening to a legal podcast on it. And she's kind of like, he's just exercising his freedom. I'm like, he's not though. And he's being paid to coach football. Like he's being paid to coach football. And if he were an Islamic coach and doing the same thing in this Christian town, he'd be persecuted for it. And no one would be on his side. Right. They wouldn't be rushing the field to support him in the name of free speech.
Yeah. Well, look at taking a knee. I mean, I don't agree with the weird. I don't watch football, so I don't care. But look at how much people cared about somebody kneeling during the national anthem.
Yeah.
Let alone praying to Allah on the field,
yeah,
right?
That's like point. That's so. To bring it back to Islam, it bothers me when Christians sort of literally use tenets of, which as you've described, seem
Islam,
like Islam, in order to sort of argue that Christianity has the same imperatives that they don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think going back to the discussion on our country, I think you and I, and I don't know where Caleb is, he believes all kinds of weird things, and we won't talk about the flat earth here, but...
Oh, my gosh.
We were schooled in, we have what some would call a classically liberal view of things, or a traditional sort of Lockean-type Republican understanding of things. Is that... You're nodding, yeah?
Yeah, that's me.
I think those who are wanting to fight the culture wars, and I get it. I really do get it because I kind of get pulled into that a bit. Is the American experiment relies so heavily on people being able to govern themselves and to respect other people and not infringe on other people, and that in a day of identity politics and tribalism and so on and so forth, that. It's some, I think, would say that the American experiment has failed.
Mm.
And to protect their children and their grandchildren and so from all the stuff that's being shoved down their throats in the government schools, and that's not a knock on people who send their kids to government schools. I send two of mine to government schools. I think they're outraged, and rightly so in many regards, but the response is not...
more freedom, more liberty.
Well, no.
Well, I mean, I think the response ought not be to dial it down on some sort of theocratic impulse.
That's what I'm saying. The response isn't more freedom, isn't more liberty.
Right.
It's to dial down on a theocratic impulse.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a rationale to it. Is all I'm saying. I get it.
There's a rationale to it when the Muslim people do it though too.
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
They're doing it. They're trying to protect. Why would you enact Sharia law politically? Well, it's to protect, the Sharia way of life politically and religiously.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it makes your religious life easier as well.
It's easier if you can just say, this is the way we all act and behave.
Yes.
Yes.
Than to try to sort of say, oh, well, that guy over there is acting and behaving in a way that's not in alignment with my values and beliefs and religious dogmas, and I have to live in the same general proximity as him, and that makes life more difficult than if everybody has to act in accordance with these beliefs.
Indeed.
That's why there's this whole carry the cross thing, right?
Yeah. I think there's just been some people who've had it in a way that we didn't in California for so long, right? We've been driving through the heartland and we go through some small towns, right? 2,000 people, three churches fully packed on Sunday. Those people don't, I can see why you're upset. Your neighbors for your entire life have been Christians of the same denomination as you. In your whole town, everybody who lives in your city, it's going to be a lot more disturbing to watch this all unfold than somebody who's, been living in liberal California your whole life, and your neighbor is nothing or something totally different than you. And the whole, if you surveyed your whole block, let alone the whole city you lived in, it's.
Well, can you imagine living, this is going to be some California arrogance here. Living there, sending your kid off then to a state school where they're introduced, not just to the ideas, which they were probably already introduced to via the internet and whatnot and TV and all that, but not just to the ideas, but to the reality and to the people and to the arguments. So it's not just that these characters are on TV anymore and these family situations are on TV anymore. Now they're coming back with the argument in favor of this way of life.
And we can bring this around to Islam, right? That produces in sort of Christian kids, and I'm sure in Islamic people who've come to this country and stuff, two things. Either extremist, sort of orthodox, like hearty, apologetic, religious adherent, or, sort of somebody who is nominally Christian or nominally Muslim or whatever, right?
And this has got to be shocking, and not as shocking if you live in California.
or Chicago area.
Or somewhere like that. It's just not as shocking. It's still upsetting. It's still disappointing in a lot of ways, but it's not as like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that we're not praying at the beginning of every class. In California, Chicago, you don't want that for your kids because
God knows who they'll be praying to. It's sort of like, did you see the stuff in the, I don't know if it was a local or a state representative gathering, legislative meeting in Alaska where because they have to bring in different people to open it up in prayer. It was like a prayer to Satan.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's,
and a bunch of people walked out. But I mean, imagine, think this though. If you grew up maybe in a small town or something like that, or wherever you grew up kind of thinking America is a Christian country, but you've never really understood what that means. And then all of a sudden you've got an iPhone. And maybe you're 80, maybe you're 60 years old and you're on TikTok. I don't know why you'd be on TikTok at that age, but
Adam and TikTok,
you could be on anything. You could be on you guys are anything,
or
lynched.
or your grandkids come to visit you and they're spouting off on all this transgender ideology or critical race theory or all these other things. It's going to be shocking to you. And your response is probably going to be a reactionary type of response. Right. And that's kind of what I think we see going on with the Christians being so heavily invested in the culture wars. Though I know there's certainly reasons, and there are things in our culture that we got to resist at the voting booth and in our as in our vocation
in
as citizens.
Vocation as citizen, that's right. All right, Adam, give us 1 minute on Islam.
I know we got into it here now, but we got to go back to why you should know something about Islam. I thought you made a pretty good case at the beginning
it's
and filled
five,
it with
5 degrees colder since we've been recording.
I can't feel my toes.
I'll tell you the real reason as a Christian why you should know something about Islam, because chances are you're going to have a neighbor, a coworker, a friend, a fellow student who's going to be Muslim, and you need to know first what what they think, what their worldview is, and also you need to, as a Christian, in your vocation as a Christian, figure out ways that you can speak the gospel to them. I think that's the Christian vocation, not changing the laws so that life's harder for the Muslim or something like that, but rather speaking the gospel to the Muslim. So,
agreed, man.
All right. Way to close it out, Adam. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Thinking Fellows. We hope you enjoyed it. This has always been a very popular topic in the past when we did this, so we hope you stick around for it. Also, big greeting to the couple thousand listeners that we've gained in the last couple of weeks. Boom. So if you've, it's been great. If you,
it's all because Adam's back.
Yes, it is. Adam, it's, you definitely get the credit. If you've been enjoying the show and you're one of these new listeners, we could really use some new reviews on Apple Podcasts. Even if you don't use the Apple Podcasts app, you can go follow the link. I'll put it in the show notes, and you can use your web browser, and you can review the show there. And we'd really appreciate 5-star reviews. When they happen in a bulk batch, it really bumps the Thinking Fellows up into search results and the like. And so when we have a group of new listeners who maybe haven't reviewed before, that's one of the best ways you can help us.
And I'm going to go find my warm shoes.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.